Lieutenant Morrissey's saying that, but Hodges himself has always had his doubts, and lately those doubts have been stronger than ever. What he knows now is that guilt isn't the only reason people commit suicide. Sometimes you can just get bored with afternoon TV. 14. Two motor patrol cops found the Mercedes an hour after the killings. It was behind one of the warehouses that cluttered the lakeshore. The huge paved yard was filled with rusty container boxes that stood around like Easter Island monoliths. The gray Mercedes was parked carelessly askew between two of them. By the time Hodges and Huntley arrived, five police cars were parked in the yard, two drawn up nose to nose behind the car's back bumper as if the cops expected the big gray sedan to start up by itself, like that old Plymouth in the horror movie, and make a run for it. The fog had thickened into a light rain. The patrol car roof racks lit the droplets in conflicting pulses of blue light. Hodges and Huntley approached the cluster of motor patrolmen. Pete Huntley spoke with the two who had discovered the car while Hodges did a walk-around. The front end of the SL-500 was only slightly crumpled, that famous German engineering, but the hood and the windshield were spattered with gore. A shirt sleeve, now stiffening with blood, was snagged in the grill. This would later be traced to August Odenkirk, one of the victims. There was something else, too. Something that gleamed even in that morning's pale light. Hodges dropped to one knee for a closer look. He was still in that position when Huntley joined him. "What the hell is that?" Pete asked. "I think a wedding ring," Hodges said. So it proved. The plain gold band belonged to Francine Reese, 39, of Squirrel Ridge Road, and was eventually returned to her family. She had to be buried with it on the third finger of her right hand because the first three fingers of the left had been torn off. The ME guessed this was because she raised it in an instinctive warding-off gesture as the Mercedes came down on her. Two of those fingers were found at the scene of the crime shortly before noon on April 10th. The index finger was never found. Hodges thought that a seagull, one of the big boys that patrolled the lakeshore, might have seized it and carried it away. He preferred that idea to the grisly alternative that an unhurt city center survivor had taken it as a souvenir. Hodges stood up and motioned one of the motor patrolmen over. "We've got to get a tarp over this before the rain washes away any." "Already on its way," the cop said and cocked a thumb at Pete. "First thing he told us." "Well, aren't you special?" Hodges said in a not too bad church lady voice, but his partner's answering smile was as pale as the day. Pete was looking at the blunt, blood-spattered snout of the Mercedes and at the ring caught in the chrome. Another cop came over, notebook in hand, open to a page already curling with moisture. His name tag ID'd him as F. Shammington. "Car's registered to Mrs. Olivia Ann Trelawney, 729 Lilac Drive, at Sugar Heights." "Where most good Mercedeses go to sleep when their long day's work is done," Hodges said. "Find out if she's at home, Officer Shammington. If she's not, see if you can track her down. Can you do that?"
"Yes, sir, absolutely."
"Just routine, right? A stolen car inquiry."
"You got it."
Hodges turned to Pete. "Front of the cabin. Notice anything?" "No airbag deployment. He disabled them. Speaks to premeditation. Also speaks to him knowing how to do it. What do you make of the mask?" Pete peered through the droplets of rain on the driver's side window, not touching the glass. Lying on the leather driver's seat was a rubber mask, the kind you pulled over your head. Tufts of orange, bozo-ish hair stuck up above the temples like horns. The nose was a red rubber bulb. Without a head to stretch it, the red-lipped smile had become a sneer. "Creepy as hell. You ever see that TV movie about the clown in the sewer?" Hodges shook his head. Later, only weeks before his retirement, he bought a DVD copy of the film, and Pete was right. The mask face was very close to the face of Pennywise, the clown in the movie. The two of them walked around the car again, this time noting blood on the tires and rocker panels. A lot of it was going to wash off before the tarp and the techs arrived. It was still 40 minutes shy of 7 a.m.
"Officers," Hodges called, and when they gathered, "who's got a cell phone with a camera?"
They all did. Hodges directed them into a circle around what he was already thinking of as the death car. One word, death car, just like that, and they began snapping pictures. Officer Shammington was standing a little apart talking on his cell phone. Pete beckoned him over. "Do you have an age on the Trelawney woman?" Shammington consulted his notebook.
"DOB on her driver's license is February 3rd, 1957, which makes her,
52, Hodges said. He and Pete Huntley had been working together for a dozen years, and by now a lot of things didn't have to be spoken aloud. Olivia Trelawney was the right sex and age for the park rapist, but totally wrong for the role of spree killer. They knew there had been cases of people losing control of their vehicles and accidentally driving into groups of people. Only 5 years ago, in this very city, a man in his 80s, borderline senile, had plowed his Buick Electra into a sidewalk cafe, killing one and injuring half a dozen others. But Olivia Trelawney didn't fit that profile either. Too young. Plus, there was the mask. But...
15.
The bill comes on a silver tray. Hodges lays his plastic on top of it and sips his coffee while he waits for it to come back. He's comfortably full, and in the middle of the day that condition usually leaves him ready for a 2-hour nap, not this afternoon. This afternoon he has never felt more awake. The but had been so apparent that neither of them had to say it out loud, not to the motor patrolman, more arriving all the time, although the goddamn tarp never got there until 7:15, and not to each other. The doors of the SL-500 were locked and the ignition slot was empty. There was no sign of tampering that either detective could see, and later that day the head mechanic from the city's Mercedes dealership confirmed that. "How hard would it be for someone to Slim Jim a window?" Hodges had asked the mechanic. "Pop the lock that way." "All but impossible," the mechanic had said. "These Mercs are built. If someone did manage to do it, it would leave signs." He had tilted his cap back on his head. "What happened is plain and simple, officers. She left the key in the ignition and ignored the reminder chime when she got out. Her mind was probably on something else. The thief saw the key and took the car. I mean, he must have had the key. How else could he lock the car when he left it?" "You keep saying she," Pete said. They hadn't mentioned the owner's name. "Hey, come on," the mechanic smiling a little now. "This is Mrs. Trelawney's Mercedes. Olivia Trelawney. She bought it at our dealership and we service it every 4 months like clockwork. We only service a few 12-cylinders and I know them all." And then, speaking nothing but the utter grisly truth, "This baby's a tank." The killer drove the Benz in between the two container boxes, killed the engine, pulled off his mask, doused it with bleach, and exited the car, the gloves and hairnet probably tucked inside his jacket. Then a final fuck you as he walked away into the fog. He locked the car with Olivia Ann Trelawney's smart key. There was your butt. 16. She warned us to be quiet because her mother was sleeping, Hodges remembers. Then she gave us coffee and cookies. Sitting in DiMaggio's, he sips the last of his current cup while he waits for his credit card to be returned. He thinks about the living room and that whopper of a condo apartment with its kick-ass view of the lake. Along with coffee and cookies, she had given them the wide-eyed, "Of course I didn't," look, the one that is the exclusive property of solid citizens who have never been in trouble with the police, who can't imagine such a thing. She even said it out loud when Pete asked if it was possible she had left her ignition key in her car when she parked it on Lake Avenue just a few doors down from her mother's building. "Of course I didn't." The words had come through a cramped little smile that said, "I find your idea silly and more than a bit insulting." The waiter returns at last. He puts down the little silver tray and Hodges slips a 10 and a 5 into his hand before he can straighten up. At DiMaggio's, the waiters split tips, a practice of which Hodges strongly disapproves. If that makes him old school, so be it.
"Thank you, sir. And buon pomeriggio."
"Back at you," Hodges says. He tucks away his receipt in his Amex but doesn't rise immediately. There are some crumbs left on his dessert plate and he uses his fork to snare them, just as he used to do with his mother's cakes when he was a little boy. To him, those last few crumbs sucked slowly onto the tongue from between the tines of the fork always seemed like the sweetest part of the slice. 17. That crucial first interview, only hours after the crime. Coffee and cookies while the mangled bodies of the dead were still being identified. Somewhere relatives were weeping and rending their garments. Mrs. Trelawney walking into the condo's front hall where her handbag sat on an occasional table. She brought the bag back rummaging, starting to frown, still rummaging, starting to be a little worried, then smiling. "Here it is," she said, and handed it over. The detectives looked at the smart key, Hodges thinking how ordinary it was for something that went with such an expensive car. It was basically a black plastic stick with a lump on the end of it. The lump was stamped with the Mercedes logo on one side. On the other were three buttons. One showed a padlock with its shackle down. On the button beside it, the padlock shackle was up. The third button was labeled Panic. Presumably, if a mugger attacked you as you were unlocking your car, you could push that one and the car would start screaming for help. "I can see why you had a little trouble locating it in your purse," Pete remarked in his best just passing the time of day voice. "Most people put a fob on their keys. My wife has hers on a big plastic daisy." He smiled fondly, as if Maureen were still his wife, and as if that perfectly turned out fashion plate would ever have been caught dead hauling a plastic daisy out of her purse. "How nice for her," Mrs. Trelawney said. "When may I have my car back?" "That's not up to us, ma'am," Hodges said. She sighed and straightened the boat neck top of her dress. It was the first of dozens of times they saw her do it. "I'll have to sell it, of course. I'd never be able to drive it after this. It's so upsetting. To think my car." Now that she had her purse in hand, she prospected again and brought out a wad of pastel Kleenex. She dabbed at her eyes with them. "It's very upsetting."
"I'd like you to take us through it one more time," Pete said.
She rolled her eyes, which were red-rimmed and bloodshot.
"Is that really necessary? I'm exhausted. I was up most of the night with my mother. She couldn't go to sleep until 4. She's in such pain. I'd like a nap before Mrs. Green comes in. She's the nurse."
Hodges thought your car was just used to kill 8 people, and only 8 if all the others live, and you want a nap. Later, he would not be sure if that was when he started to dislike Mrs. Trelawney, but it probably was. When some people were in distress, you wanted to enfold them and say, "There, there," as you patted them on the back. With others, you wanted to slap them a hard one across the chops and tell them to man up, or in Mrs. T's case, to woman up. "We'll be as quick as we can," Pete promised. He didn't tell her that this would be the first of many interviews. By the time they were done with her, she would hear herself telling her story in her sleep.
"Oh, very well, then. I arrived here at my mother's shortly after 7 o'clock on Thursday evening."
She visited at least 4 times a week, she said, but Thursdays were her night to stay over. She always stopped at Bai, a very nice vegetarian restaurant located in Birch Hill Mall, and got their dinners, which she warmed up in the oven.
"Although mother eats very little now, of course, because of the pain."
She told them she always scheduled her Thursday trips, so she arrived after 7 because that was when the all-night parking began and most of the street-side spaces were empty.
"I won't parallel park. I simply can't do it."
"What about the garage down the block?" Hodges asked. She looked at him as though he were crazy.
"It costs $16 to park there overnight. The street-side spaces are free."
Pete was still holding the key, although he hadn't yet told Mrs. Trelawney they would be taking it with them. "You stopped at Birch Hill and ordered takeout for you and your mother at..." He consulted his notebook. "Bye."
"No, I ordered ahead, from my house on Lilac Drive. They are always glad to hear from me. I am an old and valued customer. Last night it was cuckoo sabzi for mother. That's an herbal omelet with spinach and cilantro. And gai mei for me. Gai mei is a lovely stew with peas, potatoes, and mushrooms, very easy on the stomach." She straightened her boat neck. "I've had terrible acid reflux ever since I was in my teens. One learns to live with it."
"I assume your order was..."
Hodges began.
And Cholezard for dessert, she added. That's rice pudding with cinnamon and saffron. She flashed her strangely troubled smile. Like the compulsive straightening of her boat-neck tops, the smile was a Trelawneyism with which they would become very familiar. It's the saffron that makes it special. Even Mother always eats the Cholezard.
Sounds tasty, Hodges said. And your order, was it boxed and ready to go when you got there?
Yes.
One box?
Oh, no, three.
In a bag?
No, just the boxes.
Must have been quite a struggle getting all that out of your car, Pete said. Three boxes of takeout, your purse, and the key, Hodges said. Don't forget that, Pete.
Also, you'd want to get it all upstairs as fast as possible, Pete said. Cold food's no fun. I see where you're going with this, Mrs. Trelawney said, and I assure you... A slight pause. You gentlemen, that you are barking up the wrong path. I put my key in my purse as soon as I turned off the engine. It's the first thing I always do. As for the boxes, they were tied together in a stack. She held her hands about 18 inches apart to demonstrate, and that made them very easy to handle. I had my purse over my arm. Look. She crooked her arm, hung her purse on it, and marched around the big living room holding a stack of invisible boxes from by. See?
Yes, ma'am, Hodges said. He thought he saw something else as well.
As for hurrying, no, there was no need, since the dinners need to be heated up anyway. She paused. Not the Cholezard, of course. No need to heat up rice pudding. She uttered a small laugh. Not a giggle, Hodges thought, but a titter.
Given that her husband was dead, he supposed you could even call it a widder titter. His dislike added another layer, almost thin enough to be invisible, but not quite. No, not quite. So, let me review your actions once you got here to Lake Avenue, Hodges said, where you arrived at a little past 7.
Yes, 5 past, perhaps a little more.
Uh-huh. You park, what, 3 or 4 doors down?
4 at most. All I need are 2 empty spaces so I can pull in without backing. I hate to back. I always turn the wrong way.
Yes, ma'am, my wife has exactly the same problem. You turned off the engine... You removed the key from the ignition and put it in your purse. You put your purse over your arm and picked up the boxes with the food in them.
The stack of boxes, tied together with good stout string.
The stack, right. Then what?
She looked at him as though he were, of all the idiots in a generally idiotic world, the greatest. Then I went to my mother's building. Mrs. Harris, the housekeeper, you know, buzzed me in. On Thursdays, she leaves as soon as I arrive. I took the elevator up to the 19th floor, where you are now asking me questions instead of telling me when I can deal with my car. My stolen car.
Hodges made a mental note to ask the housekeeper if she had noticed Mrs. T's Mercedes when she left. Pete asked, At what point did you take your key from your purse again, Mrs. Trelawney?
Again? Why would I...
He held the key up, Exhibit A.
To lock your car before you entered the building. You did lock it, didn't you?
A brief uncertainty flashed in her eyes. They both saw it. Then it was gone.
Of course I did.
Hodges pinned her gaze. It shifted away toward the lake view out the big picture window, and he caught it again. Think carefully, Mrs. Trelawney. People are dead, and this is important. Do you specifically remember juggling those boxes of food so you could get your key out of your purse and push the lock button? And seeing the headlights flash an acknowledgement. They do that, you know.
Of course I know.
She bit at her lower lip, realized she was doing it, stopped. Do you remember that specifically?
For a moment, all expression left her face. Then that superior smile burst forth in all its irritating glory. Wait. Now I remember. I put the key in my purse after I gathered up my boxes and got out, and after I pushed the button that locks the car.
You sure? Pete said.
Yes, she was, and would remain so.
They both knew that. The way a solid citizen who hit and ran would say when he was finally tracked down that of course it was a dog he'd hit. Pete flipped his notebook closed and stood up. Hodges did likewise.
Mrs. Trelawney looked more than eager to escort them to the door.
"One more question," Hodges said as they reached it.
She raised carefully plucked eyebrows.
"Yes?"
"Where's your spare key? We ought to take that one, too."
There was no blank look this time, no cutting away of the eyes, no hesitation. She said, "I have no spare key and no need of one. I'm very careful of my things, officer. I've owned my gray lady, that's what I call it, for 5 years, and the only key I've ever used is now in your partner's pocket."
18. The table where he and Pete ate their lunch has been cleared of everything but his half-finished glass of water, yet Hodges goes on sitting there, staring out the window at the parking lot and the overpass that marks the unofficial border of Lowtown, where Sugar Heights residents like the late Olivia Trelawney never venture. Why would they? To buy drugs? Hodges is sure there are druggies in the Heights, plenty of them, but when you live there, the dealers make house calls. Mrs. T was lying. She had to lie. It was that or face the fact that a single moment of forgetfulness had led to horrific consequences. Suppose, though, just for the sake of argument, that she was telling the truth. Okay, let's suppose. But if we were wrong about her leaving her Mercedes unlocked with the key in the ignition, how were we wrong? And what did happen? He sits looking out the window, remembering, unaware that some of the waiters have begun to look at him uneasily, the overweight retiree sitting slumped in his seat like a robot with dead batteries. 19. The death car had been transported to police impound on a carrier still locked. Hodges and Huntley received this update when they got back to their own car. The head mechanic from Ross Mercedes had just arrived and was pretty sure he could unlock the damn thing, eventually. "Tell him not to bother," Hodges said. "We've got her key." There was a pause at the other end, and then Lieutenant Morrissey said, "You do? You're not saying she..." "No, no, nothing like that. Is the mechanic standing by, Lieutenant?"
"He's in the yard looking at the damage to the car. Damn near tears is what I heard."
"He might want to save a drop or two for the dead people," Pete said. He was driving. The windshield wipers beat back and forth. The rain was coming harder. "Just saying." "Tell him to get in touch with the dealership and check something," Hodges said. "Then have him call me on my cell." The traffic was snarled downtown, partly because of the rain, partly because Marlborough Street had been blocked off at city center. They had made only 4 blocks when Hodges' cell rang. It was Howard McGrory, the mechanic. "Did you have someone at the dealership check on what I was curious about?" Hodges asked him.
"No need," McGrory said. "I've worked at Ross since 1987, must have seen 1,000 Merces go out the door since then, and I can tell you they all go out with 2 keys.
"Thanks," Hodges said. "We'll be there soon. Got some more questions for you."
"I'll be here. This is terrible. Terrible."
Hodges ended the call and passed on what McGrory had said. "Are you surprised?" Pete asked. Ahead was an orange detour sign that would vector them around city center, unless they wanted to light their blues, that was, and neither did. What they needed now was to talk. "Nope," Hodges said. "It's standard operating procedure. Like the Brits say, an heir and a spare. They give you 2 keys when you buy your new car, and tell you to put one in a safe place so you can lay hands on it if you lose the one you carry around. Some people, if they need the spare a year or two later, they've forgotten where they put it. Women who carry big purses, like that suitcase the Trelawney woman had, are apt to dump both keys into it and forget all about the extra one. If she's telling the truth about not putting it on a fob, she was probably using them interchangeably." "Yeah," Hodges said. "She gets to her mother's. She's preoccupied with the thought of spending another night dealing with Mom's pain. She's juggling the boxes and her purse. And left the key in the ignition. She doesn't want to admit it, not to us and not to herself, but that's what she did." "Although the warning chime," Hodges said doubtfully. "Maybe a big noisy truck was going by as she was getting out and she didn't hear the chime, or a police car whining its siren. Or maybe she was just so deep in her own thoughts she ignored it." It made sense then, and even more later when McGrory told them the death car hadn't been jimmied to gain entry or hotwired to start. What troubled Hodges, the only thing that troubled him really,
was how much he wanted it to make sense. Neither of them had liked Mrs. Trelawney, she of the boat-neck tops, perfectly plucked brows, and squeaky witter-titter. Mrs. Trelawney, who hadn't asked for any news of the dead and injured, not so much as a single detail. She wasn't the doer, no way was she, but it would be good to stick her with some of the blame, give her something to think about besides veggie dinners from by.
"Don't complicate what's simple," his partner repeated. The traffic snarl had cleared, and he put the pedal down. "She was given two keys. She claimed she only had one, and now it's the truth. The bastard who killed those people probably threw the one she left in the ignition down a handy sewer when he walked away. The one she showed us was the spare."
That had to be the answer. When you heard hoofbeats, you didn't think zebras.
20.
Someone is shaking him gently, the way you shake a heavy sleeper. And Hodges realizes he almost has been asleep, or hypnotized by recollection. It's Elaine, the DiMaggio's hostess, and she's looking at him with concern.
"Detective Hodges, are you all right?"
"Fine, but it's just Mr. Hodges now, Elaine. I'm retired." He sees concern in her eyes, and something more, something worse. He's the only patron left in the restaurant. He observes the waiters clustered around the doorway to the kitchen and suddenly sees himself as they and Elaine must be seeing him, an old fellow who's been sitting here long after his dining companion and everyone else has left. An old, overweight fellow who sucked the last of his cake off his fork like a child sucking a lollipop and then just stared out the window. "They're wondering if I'm riding into the kingdom of dementia on the Alzheimer's Express," he thinks. He smiles at Elaine, his number one, wide and charming. "Pete and I were talking about old cases. I was thinking about one, kind of replaying it. Sorry, I'll clear out now." But when he gets up, he staggers and bumps the table, knocking over the half-empty water glass. Elaine grabs his shoulder to steady him, looking more concerned than ever.
"Detective, Mr. Hodges, are you okay to drive?"
"Sure," he says too heartily. Pins and needles are doing wind sprints from his ankles to his crotch and then back down to his ankles again. "Just had two glasses of beer. Pete drank the rest. My legs went to sleep, that's all."
"Oh, are you better now?"
"Fine," he says, and his legs really are better. Thank God. He remembers reading somewhere that older men, especially older, overweight men, should not sit too long. A blood clot can form behind the knee. You get up, the released clot does its own lethal wind sprint up to the heart, and it's angel, angel, down we go. She walks with him to the door. Hodges finds himself thinking of the private nurse whose job it was to watch over Mrs. T's mother. What was her name? Harris? No, Harris was the housekeeper. The nurse was Green. When Mrs. Wharton wanted to go into the living room or visit the Jakes, did Mrs. Green escort her the way Elaine is escorting him now? Of course she did. "Elaine, I'm fine," he says. "Really. Sober mind, body in balance." He holds his arms out to demonstrate.
"All right," she says. "Come see us again. And next time, don't wait so long."
"It's a promise." He looks at his watch as he pushes out into the bright sunshine. Past 2. He's missing his afternoon shows and doesn't mind a bit. The lady judge and the Nazi psychologist can go fuck themselves. Or each other. 21. He walks slowly into the parking lot where the only cars left other than his likely belong to the restaurant staff. He takes his keys out and jingles them on his palm. Unlike Mrs. T's, the key to his Toyota is on a ring. And yes, there's a fob, a rectangle of plastic with a picture of his daughter beneath. Allie at 17, smiling and wearing her city-high lacrosse uni. In a matter of the Mercedes key, Mrs. Trelawney never recanted. Through all the interviews, she continued to insist she'd only ever had the one, even after Pete Huntley showed her the invoice with primary keys 2, on the list of items that went with her new car when she took possession back in 2004, she continued to insist. She said the invoice was mistaken. Hodges remembers the iron certainty in her voice. Pete would say that she copped to it in the end. There was no need of a note. Suicide is a confession by its very nature. Her wall of denial finally crumbled, like when the guy who hit and ran finally gets it off his chest. Yes, okay, it was a kid, not a dog. It was a kid, and I was looking at my cell phone to see whose call I missed, and I killed him. Hodges remembers how their subsequent interviews with Mrs. T had produced a weird kind of amplifying effect. The more she denied, the more they disliked. Not just Hodges and Huntley, but the whole squad. And the more they disliked, the more stridently she denied, because she knew how they felt. Oh, yes, she was self-involved, but not stoop. Hodges stops, one hand on the sun-warmed door handle of his car, the other shading his eyes. He's looking into the shadows beneath the turnpike overpass. It's almost mid-afternoon, and the denizens of Lowtown have begun to rise from their crypts. Four of them are in those shadows, three big'uns and one little'un. The big'uns appear to be pushing the little'un around. The little'un is wearing a pack, and as Hodges watches, one of the big'uns rips it from his back. This provokes a burst of troll-like laughter. Hodges strolls down the broken sidewalk to the overpass. He doesn't think about it, and he doesn't hurry. He stuffs his hands in his sport coat pockets. Cars and trucks drone by on the turnpike extension, projecting their shapes on the street below in a series of shadow shutters. He hears one of the trolls asking the little kid how much money he's got.
"Ain't got none," the little kid says. "Leave me alone."
"Turn out your pockets and we see," Troll 2 says. The kid tries to run instead. Troll 3 wraps his arms around the kid's skinny chest from behind. Troll 1 grabs at the kid's pockets and squeezes.
"Yo, yo, I hear folding money," he says,
and the little kid's face squinches up in an effort not to cry.
"My brother finds out who you are, he busts a cap on your asses," he says. "That's a terrifying idea," Troll 1 says. "Just about made me want to pee my..."
Then he sees Hodges ambling into the shadows to join them with his belly leading the way. His hands deep in the pockets of his old shapeless houndstooth check, the one with the patches on the elbows, the one he can't bear to give up even though he knows it's shot to shit.
"What you want?"
Troll 3 asks. He's still hugging the kid from behind. Hodges considers trying a John Wayne drawl and decides not to. The only Wayne these scuzzbags would know is Little. "I want you to leave the little man alone," he says. "Get out of here. Right now." Troll 1 lets go of the little one's pockets. He is wearing a hoodie and the obligatory Yankees cap. He puts his hands on his slim hips and cocks his head to one side, looking amused.
"Fuck off, fatty."
Hodges doesn't waste time. There are three of them, after all. He takes the happy slapper from his right coat pocket, liking its old comforting weight. The slapper is an argyle sock. The foot part is filled with ball bearings. It's knotted at the ankle to make sure the steel balls stay in. He swings it at the side of Troll 1's neck in a tight, flat arc, careful to steer clear of the Adam's apple. Hit a guy there, you were apt to kill him, and then you were stuck in the bureaucracy. There's a metallic thwap. Troll 1 lurches sideways, his look of amusement turning to pained surprise. He stumbles off the curb and falls into the street. He rolls onto his back, gagging, clutching his neck, staring up at the underside of the overpass. Troll 3 starts forward. "Fucking," he begins, and then Hodges lifts his leg, pins and needles all gone, thank God, and kicks him briskly in the crotch. He hears the seat of his trousers rip and thinks, "Oh, you fat fuck." Troll 3 lets out a yowl of pain. Under here, with the cars and trucks passing overhead, the sound is strangely flat. He doubles over. Hodges' left hand is still in his coat. He extends his index finger so it pokes out the pocket and points it at Troll 2. "Hey, fuckface, no need to wait for the little man's big brother. I'll bust a cap on your ass myself. 3-on-1 pisses me off."
"No, man, no!"
Troll 2 is tall, well-built, maybe 15, but his terror regresses him to no more than 12.
"Please, man, we us just playing."
"Then run, playboy," Hodges says. "Do it now." Troll 2 runs. Troll 1, meanwhile, has gotten on his knees. You gonna regret this, Fat Mac?
Hodges takes a step toward him, lifting the slapper. Troll One sees it, gives a girly shriek, covers his neck.
You better run too, Hodges says, or the fat man's going to tool up on your face. When your mama gets to the emergency room, she'll walk right past you. In that moment, with his adrenaline flowing and his blood pressure probably over 200, he absolutely means it.
Troll One gets up. Hodges makes a mock lunge at him, and Troll One jerks back most satisfyingly.
Take your friend with you and pack some ice on his balls, Hodges says. They're going to swell.
Troll One gets his arm around Troll Three, and they hobble toward the Lowtown side of the overpass. When Troll One considers himself safe, he turns back and says,
I see you again, fat man.
Pray to God you don't, fuckwit, Hodges says.
He picks up the backpack and hands it to the kid who's looking at him with wide, mistrustful eyes. He might be 10. Hodges drops the slapper back into his pocket.
Why aren't you in school, little man?
My mama's sick. I go in to get her medicine.
This is a lie so audacious that Hodges has to grin.
No, you're not, he says. You're skipping.
The kid says nothing. This is 5-0. Nobody else would step to it the way this guy did. Nobody else would have a loaded sock in his pocket either. Safer to dummy up.
You go skip someplace safer, Hodges says. There's a playground on 8th Avenue. Try there.
They selling the rock on that playground,
the kid says.
I know, Hodges says almost kindly, but you don't have to buy any.
He could add, you don't have to run any either, but that would be naive. Down in Lowtown, most of the shorties run it. You can bust a 10-year-old for possession, but try making it stick.
He starts back to the parking lot, on the safe side of the overpass. When he glances back, the kid is still standing there and looking at him, pack dangling from one hand.
Little man, Hodges says. The kid looks at him, saying nothing.
Hodges lifts one hand and points at him. I did something good for you just now. Before the sun goes down tonight, I want you to pass it on.
Now the kid's look is one of utter incomprehension, as if Hodges just lapsed into a foreign language, but that's all right. Sometimes it seeps through, especially with the young ones. People would be surprised, Hodges thinks. They really would.
22. Brady Hartsfield changes into his other uniform, the white one, and checks his truck, quickly going through the inventory sheet the way Mr. Loeb likes. Everything is there. He pops his head in the office to say hi to Shirley Orton. Shirley is a fat pig, all too fond of the company product, but he wants to stay on her good side. Brady wants to stay on everyone's good side. Much safer that way. She has a crush on him, and that helps.
"Shirley, you pretty girly," he cries, and she blushes all the way up to the hairline of her pimple-studded forehead.
"Little piggy, oink, oink, oink," Brady thinks.
"You're so fat your cunt probably turns inside out when you sit down."
"Hi, Brady, West Side again?"
"All week, darling. You okay?"
"Fine,"
blushing harder than ever.
"Good, just wanted to say howdy."
Then he's off, obeying every speed limit, even though it takes him 40 fucking minutes to get into his territory driving that slow. But it has to be that way. Get caught speeding in a company truck after the school's let out for the day, you get canned. No recourse. But when he gets to the West Side, this is the good part. He's in Hodges' neighborhood, and with every reason to be there. Hide in plain sight, that's the old saying. And as far as Brady is concerned, it's a wise saying. Indeed. He turns off Spruce Street and cruises slowly down Harper Road, right past the old Det Rett's house. "Oh, look here," he thinks. "The nigger kid is out front, stripped to the waist, so all the stay-at-home mommies can get a good look at his sweat-oiled six-pack, no doubt, and pushing a lawn boy."
About time you got after that, Brady thinks. It was looking mighty shaggy. Not that the old Det Rett probably took much notice. The old Det Rett was too busy watching TV, eating Pop-Tarts, and playing with that gun he kept on the table beside his chair.
The nigger kid hears him coming even over the roar of the mower and turns to look. I know your name, nigger kid, Brady thinks. It's Jerome Robinson. I know almost everything about the old debt ret. I don't know if he's queer for you, but I wouldn't be surprised. It could be why he keeps you around. From behind the wheel of his little Mr. Tasty truck, which is covered with happy kid decals and jingles with happy recorded bells, Brady waves. The nigger kid waves back and smiles. Sure he does. Everybody likes the ice cream man. Under Debbie's Blue Umbrella. 1. Brady Hartsfield cruises the tangle of West Side streets until 7:30 when dusk starts to drain the blue from the late spring sky. His first wave of customers, between 3 and 6 p.m., consists of after-school kids wearing backpacks and waving crumpled dollar bills. Most don't even look at him. They're too busy blabbing to their buddies or talking into the cell phones they see not as accessories, but as necessities every bit as vital as food and air. A few of them say thank you, but most don't bother. Brady doesn't mind. He doesn't want to be looked at, and he doesn't want to be remembered. To these brats, he's just the sugar pusher in the white uniform, and that's the way he likes it. From 6 to 7 is dead time while the little animals go in for their dinners. Maybe a few, the ones who say thank you, even talk to their parents. Most probably go right on poking the buttons of their phones while mommy and daddy yak to each other about their jobs or watch the evening news so they can find out all about the big world out there where movers and shakers are actually doing shit. During his last half hour, business picks up again. This time it's the parents as well as the kids who approach the jingling Mr. Tasty truck buying ice cream treats they'll eat with their asses, mostly fat ones snugged down in backyard lawn chairs. He almost pities them. They are people of little vision, as stupid as ants crawling around their hill. A mass killer is serving them ice cream and they have no idea. From time to time, Brady has wondered how hard it would be to poison a truckload of treats. The vanilla, the chocolate, the berry good, the flavor of the day, the tasty frosties, the brownie delights, even the freeze sticks and whistle pops. He has gone so far as to research this on the internet. He has done what Anthony Tones Frobisher, his boss at Discount Electronics, would probably call a feasibility study, and concluded that while it would be possible, it would also be stupid. It's not that he's averse to taking a risk. He got away with the Mercedes massacre when the odds of being caught were better than those of getting away clean. But he doesn't want to be caught now. He's got work to do. His work this late spring and early summer is the fat ex-cop K. William Hodges. He might cruise his west side route with a truckload of poisoned ice cream after the ex-cop gets tired of playing with the gun he keeps beside his living room chair and actually uses it. But not until. The fat ex-cop bugs Brady Hartsfield. Bugs him bad. Hodges retired with full honors. They even threw him a party. And how was that right when he had failed to catch the most notorious criminal this city had ever seen? 2. On his last circuit of the day, he cruises by the house on Teaberry Lane where Jerome Robinson, Hodges' hired boy, lives with his mother, father, and kid's sister. Jerome Robinson also bugs Brady. Robinson is good-looking, he works for the ex-cop, and he goes out every weekend with different girls. All of the girls are pretty. Some are even white. That's wrong. It's against nature.
Hey, Robinson cries. Mr. Ice Cream Man, wait up.
He sprints lightly across his lawn with his dog, a big Irish setter, running at his heels. Behind them comes the kid's sister, who is about 9.
Get me a chocolate, Jerry, she cries. Please.
He even has a white kid's name, Jerome. Jerry. It's offensive. Why can't he be Tremor, or Devon, or Leroy? Why can't he be fucking Kunta Kinte? Jerome's feet are sockless in his moccasins, his ankles still green from cutting the ex-cop's lawn. He's got a big smile on his undeniably handsome face, and when he flashes it at his weekend dates, Brady just bets those girls drop their pants and hold out their arms.
Come on in, Jerry.
Brady himself has never been with a girl.
How you doing, man?
Jerome asks. Brady, who has left the wheel and now stands at the service window, grins.
I'm fine. It's almost quitting time, and that always makes me fine. You have any chocolate left? The Little Mermaid there wants some.
Brady gives him a thumbs up, still grinning. It's pretty much the same grin he was wearing under the clown mask when he tore into the crowd of sad sack job seekers at City Center with the accelerator pedal pushed to the mat.
It's a big 10-4 on the chocolate, my friend.
The little sister arrives, eyes sparkling, braids bouncing. Don't you call me Little Mermaid, Jer. I hate that. She's 9 or so and also has a ridiculously white name, Barbara. Brady finds the idea of a black child named Barbara so surreal it's not even offensive. The only one in the family with a nigger name is the dog standing on his hind legs with his paws planted on the side of the truck and his tail wagging.
Down, Odell,
Jerome says, and the dog sits panting and looking cheerful.
What about you?
Brady asks Jerome. Something for you?
A vanilla sauce served, please.
Vanilla's what you'd like to be, Brady thinks, and gets them their orders. He likes to keep an eye on Jerome. He likes to know about Jerome. Because these days, Jerome seems to be the only person who spends any time with the Detrette. And in the last 2 months, Brady has observed them together enough to see that Hodges treats the kid as a friend as well as a part-time employee. Brady has never had friends himself. Friends are dangerous. But he knows what they are. Sops to the ego. Emotional safety nets. When you're feeling bad, who do you turn to? Your friends, of course. And your friends say stuff like, aw gee, and cheer up, and we're with you, and let's go out for a drink. Jerome is only 17, not yet old enough to go out with Hodges for a drink, unless it's soda. But he can always say, cheer up, and I'm with you. So he bears watching. Mrs. Trelawney didn't have any friends. No husband either. Just her old sick mommy. Which made her easy meat, especially after the cops started working her over. Why, they had done half of Brady's work for him. The rest he did for himself, pretty much right under the scrawny bitch's nose.
Here you go,
Brady says, handing Jerome ice cream treats he wishes were spiked with arsenic. Or maybe warfarin. Load them up with that and they'd bleed out from their eyes and ears and mouths, not to mention their assholes. He imagines all the kids on the west side dropping their packs and their precious cell phones while the blood poured from every orifice. What a disaster movie that would make. Jerome gives him a tin, and along with his change, Brady hands back a dog biscuit.
For Odell, he says.
Thanks, mister,
Barbara says, and licks her chocolate cone.
This is good. Enjoy it, honey.
He drives the Mr. Tasty truck, and he frequently drives a Cyber Patrol VW on outcalls. But his real job this summer is Detective K. William Hodges, Rhett, and making sure Detective Hodges, Rhett, uses that gun. Brady heads back toward Loeb's ice cream factory to turn in his truck and change into his street clothes. He keeps to the speed limit the whole way. Always safe, never sorry.
3. After leaving DiMaggio's, with a side trip to deal with the bullies hassling the little kid beneath the Turnpike Extension overpass, Hodges simply drives, piloting his Toyota through the city streets without any destination in mind. Or so he thinks, until he realizes he is on Lilac Drive in the posh lakeside suburb of Sugar Heights. There he pulls over and parks across the street from a gated drive with a plaque reading 729 on one of the fieldstone posts. The late Olivia Trelawney's house stands at the top of an asphalt drive almost as wide as the street it fronts. On the gate is a for sale sign inviting qualified buyers to call Michael Zaffron Realty and Fine Homes. Hodges thinks that sign is apt to be there a while given the housing market in this year of our Lord 2010. But somebody is keeping the grass cut, and given the size of the lawn, the somebody must be using a mower a lot bigger than Hodges' lawn boy. Who's paying for the upkeep? Gotta be Mrs. T's estate. She had certainly been rolling in dough. He seems to recall that the probated figure was in the neighborhood of $7 million. For the first time since his retirement, when he turned the unsolved case of the City Center massacre over to Pete Huntley and Isabel Janes,
Hodges wonders if Mrs. T's mother is still alive. He remembers the scoliosis that bent the poor old lady almost double and left her in terrible pain. But scoliosis isn't necessarily fatal. Also, hadn't Olivia Trelawney had a sister living somewhere out west? He fishes for the sister's name but can't come up with it. What he does remember is that Pete took to calling Mrs. Trelawney Mrs. Twitchy because she couldn't stop adjusting her clothes and brushing it tightly bunned hair that needed no brushing and fiddling with the gold band of her Patek Philippe watch, turning it around and around on her bony wrist. Hodges disliked her. Pete had almost come to loathe her, which made saddling her with some of the blame for the city center atrocity rather satisfying. She had enabled the guy, after all. How could there be any doubt? She had been given two keys when she bought the Mercedes, but had been able to produce only one. Then, shortly before Thanksgiving, the suicide. Hodges remembers clearly what Pete said when they got the news. If she meets those dead people on the other side, especially the Craig girl and her baby, she's going to have some serious questions to answer. For Pete, it had been the final confirmation. Somewhere in her mind, Mrs. T had known all along that she had left her key in the ignition of the car she called her Gray Lady. Hodges had believed it too. The question is, does he still? Or has the poison pin letter he got yesterday from the self-confessed Mercedes killer changed his mind? Maybe not, but that letter raises questions. Suppose Mr. Mercedes had written a similar missive to Mrs. Trelawney. Mrs. Trelawney, with all those tics and insecurities just below a thin crust of defiance. Wasn't it possible? Mr. Mercedes certainly would have known about the anger and contempt with which the public had showered her in the wake of the killings. All he had to do was read the letters to the editor page of the local paper. Is it possible? But here his thoughts break off, because a car is pulled up behind him, so close it's almost touching his Toyota's bumper. There are no jackpot lights on the roof, but it's a late-model Crown Vic powder blue. The man getting out from behind the wheel is burly and crew-cut, his sport coat no doubt covering a gun and a shoulder holster. If this were a city detective, Hodges knows the gun would be a Glock 40, just like the one in his safe at home. But he's not a city detective. Hodges still knows them all. He rolls down his window.
Afternoon, sir, Crewcut says. May I ask what you're doing here? Because you've been parked quite a while.
Hodges glances at his watch and sees this is true. It's almost 4:30. Given the rush hour traffic downtown, he'll be lucky to get home in time to watch Scott Pelley on CBS Evening News. He used to watch NBC until he decided Brian Williams was a good-natured goof who's too fond of YouTube videos. Not the sort of newscaster he wants when it seems like the whole world is falling apart.
Sir, sincerely hoping for an answer here.
Crewcut bends down. The side of his sport coat gapes open. Not a Glock, but a Ruger. Sort of a cowboy gun, in Hodges' opinion.
And I, Hodges says, am sincerely hoping you have the authority to ask. His interlocutor's brow creases.
Beg pardon?
I think you're private security, Hodges says patiently, but I want to see some ID. Then you know what? I want to see your carry concealed permit for the cannon you've got inside your coat. And it better be in your wallet and not in the glove compartment of your car, or you're in violation of Section 19 of the City Firearms Code, which briefly stated as this. If you carry concealed, you must also carry your permit to carry concealed, so let's see your paperwork.
Crewcut's frown deepens. Are you a cop?
Retired, Hodges says. But that doesn't mean I've forgotten either my rights or your responsibilities. Let me see your ID and your carry permit, please. You don't have to hand them over.
You're damn right I don't.
But I want to see them, then we can discuss my presence here on Lilac Drive. Crewcut thinks it over, but only for a few seconds. Then he takes out his wallet and flips it open. In this city, as in most, Hodges thinks, security personnel treat retired cops as they would those on active duty, because retired cops have plenty of friends who are on active duty and who can make life difficult if given a reason to do so. The guy turns out to be Radney Peoples, and his company card identifies him as an employee of Vigilant Guard Service. He also shows Hodges a permit to carry concealed, which is good until June of 2012.
Radney, not Rodney, Hodges says. Like Radney Foster, the country singer.
Peoples' face breaks into a grin.
That's right.
Mr. Peoples, my name's Bill Hodges. I ended my tour as a detective first class, and my last big case was the Mercedes killer. I'm guessing that'll give you a pretty good idea of what I'm doing here.
Mrs. Trelawney, Peoples says and steps back respectfully as Hodges opens his car door, gets out, and stretches.
Little trip down memory lane, detective?
I'm just a mister these days, Hodges offers his hand. Peoples shakes it. Otherwise, you're correct. I retired from the cops at about the same time Mrs. Trelawney retired from life in general.
That was sad, Peoples said. Do you know that kids egged her gate?
Not just at Halloween, either.
3 or 4 times. We caught one bunch. The others, he shook his head. Plus toilet paper.
Yeah, they love that, Hodges says.
And one night someone tagged the left-hand gatepost. We got it taken care of before she saw it, and I'm glad. You know what it said?
Hodges shakes his head. Peoples lowers his voice.
Killer cunt, is what it said, in big drippy capital letters, which was absolutely not fair. She goofed up, that's all.
Is there any of us who haven't at one time or another?
Not me, that's for sure, Hodges says.
Right. Bible says let him who is without sin cast the first stone.
That'll be the day, Hodges thinks and asks, with honest curiosity. Did you like her?
Peoples' eyes shift up and to the left, an involuntary movement Hodges has seen in a great many interrogation rooms over the years.
It means Peoples is either going to duck the question or outright lie. It turns out to be a duck.
Well, he says, she treated us right at Christmas. She sometimes mixed up the names, but she knew who we all were, and we each got $40 and a bottle of whiskey. Good whiskey. Do you think we got that from her husband? He snorts. $10 tucked inside a Hallmark card was what we got when that skinflint was still in the saddle.
Who exactly does Vigilant work for?
It's called the Sugar Heights Association. You know, one of those neighborhood things. They fight over the zoning regulations when they don't like them and make sure everyone in the neighborhood keeps to a certain, standard, I guess you'd say. There are lots of rules, like you can put up white lights at Christmas but not colored ones, and they can't blink.
Hodges rolls his eyes. Peoples grins. They have gone from potential antagonists to colleagues, almost anyway. And why? Because Hodges happened to recognize the guy's slightly off-center first name. You could call that luck, but there's always something that will get you on the same side as the person you want to question. Something. And part of Hodges' success on the cops came from being able to recognize it, at least in most cases. It's a talent Pete Huntley never had, and Hodges is delighted to find his remains in good working order.
I think she had a sister, he says. Mrs. Trelawney, I mean. Never met her, though, and can't remember the name.
Janelle Patterson, Peoples says promptly.
You have met her, I take it.
Yes, indeed, she's good people. Bears a resemblance to Mrs. Trelawney, but younger and better looking. His hands describe an hourglass shape in the air. More filled out. Do you happen to know if there's been any progress on the Mercedes thing, Mr. Hodges?
This isn't a question Hodges would ordinarily answer, but if you want to get information, you have to give information, and what he has is safe enough because it isn't information at all. He uses the phrase Pete Huntley used at lunch a few hours ago. Dead in the water. Peoples nods as if this is no more than he expected.
Crime of impulse. No ties to any of the Vicks, no motive, just a goddamn thrill-killing. Best chance of getting him is if he tries to do it again, don't you think?
Mr. Mercedes says he won't, Hodges thinks, but this is information he absolutely doesn't want to give out, so he agrees. Collegial agreement is always good.
Mrs. T left a big estate, Hodges says, and I'm not just talking about the house. I wonder if the sister inherited.
Oh, yeah, Peoples says. He pauses, then says something Hodges himself will say to someone else in the not-too-distant future. Can I trust your discretion?
Yes.
When asked such a question, the simple answer is best, no qualifiers.
The Patterson woman was living in Los Angeles when her sister, you know, the pills?
Hodges nods.
Married, but no children. Not a happy marriage. When she found out she had inherited megabucks in a Sugar Heights estate, she divorced the husband like a shot and came east.
Peoples jerks a thumb at the gate, the wide drive and the big house.
Lived there for a couple of months while the will was going through probate. Got close with Mrs. Wilcox down at 640.
Mrs. Wilcox likes to talk and sees me as a friend.
This might mean anything from coffee buddies to afternoon sex.
Ms. Patterson took over visiting the mother who lived in a condo building downtown. You know about the mother?